This episode is sponsored by yet another company that I truly stand behind, and that is Levels. And Levels is going to be offering you, the Behind the Shield podcast audience, a discount that I will tell you about at the end of this introduction. Now, before I even dive into what Levels does, when I had a conversation with their CEO and founder, Josh Clementi, he underlined such an important topic. So many of us rely on visits to our physicians to tell us how we are doing, and that is so backward. I am an absolute believer in putting autonomy back into the hands of the individual so they can take care of their own health. Now, what Levels does is it gives us the metrics so we can see exactly how everything is internally. So they help people improve their health through continuous glucose monitoring, comprehensive lab tests, and metabolic coaching. Now, through their three levels that they offer, they have programs that focus on weight loss, heart health, and glucose stability. I've now been through this program twice, and I'll kind of illustrate what it will look like. So you make an initial consultation with your Levels coach. You wear a continuous blood sugar monitor for 1 month. You'll complete a lab panel, and I did it through Quest Diagnostics. A clinician with Levels will then analyze your results and give you an action plan. That's when you can then start hitting your own health goals and in real time track your own progress. And then depending on the level you subscribe to, there's also a second blood work so you can now see how you're doing 6 months later. Now, by combining AI data, AI-powered insights, and human coaching together, 80% of Levels members improve their biomarkers. Now, as I mentioned, Levels is offering you, the audience of the Behind the Shield podcast, $100 off your first order if you use the promo code SHIELD at levels.com. And if you're interested in getting Levels for your department, email Josh Clemente, the founder and CEO of Levels, at josh@levels.com. And if you want to hear the origin story and so much more about this incredible company, listen to my interview with CEO and founder Josh Clemente on episode 1159 of the Behind the Shield podcast. Welcome to the Behind the Shield podcast. As always, my name is James Gearing, and this week it is my absolute honor to welcome on the show CEO and co-founder of Stationwise, Marcus Edwards. So in this conversation, we discuss a host of topics, from growing up in a firefighter family, his journey into the world of data analysis, creating an app that navigates not only staffing, but firefighter health, the integration of wearables, the ability to pull reports on money wasted to therefore justify proactive staffing, and so much more. Now, before we get to this incredible conversation, as I say every week, please just take a moment. Go to whichever app you listen to this on, subscribe to the show, leave feedback, and leave a rating. Every single 5-star rating truly does elevate this podcast, therefore making it easier for others to find. And this is a free library of well over 1,100 episodes now. So all I ask in return is that you help share these incredible men and women's stories so I can get them to every single person on planet Earth who needs to hear them. So with that being said, I introduce to you Marcus Edwards. Enjoy. Well, Marcus, I want to start by saying thank you so much for taking the time and coming on the Behind the Shield podcast today.
Yeah, appreciate you having me. Glad to be here.
That is a beautiful living room behind you, by the way.
Yeah, they have awesome virtual backgrounds here.
So. I always wonder, like, what's behind it? You know, is there someone being killed or, you know, right. Middle of a war
no
zone?
No green screen or anything, just, you know, normal room, unfortunately. Sorry to disappoint.
All right. Well, very first question, where on planet Earth are we finding you today?
I'm in San Francisco.
Brilliant. Well, I would love to start at the very beginning of your journey. So tell me where you were born and tell me a little bit about your family dynamic, what your parents did, how many siblings.
Yeah, absolutely. I was born in Mount Pleasant, Iowa. Mom had me in undergrad, so was very much the oldest child, watching a young mother who had to do a lot in terms of work. So work ethic was very big for me growing up. She was always working and very hard at that. And then my dad is actually my biological stepdad. He adopted my sister and I in seventh grade. So he is in the fire service, as well as my uncle, and then my dad's dad, and then another uncle as well. So four firefighter family members. My aunt is a police sergeant, or formerly just retired from that. So very much a first responder family. And I'm the oldest with three younger sisters. So very much was more of the, responsible older sibling in many cases, helping my younger sisters out. Definitely wanted more of a boy in the house, which would have been nice to have someone to play with, but, was more the responsible one growing up. And then we lived in the Chicago suburbs. My dad was a firefighter out in Evanston, up north from there.
When you reflect back now, what were the pros and what were the cons of growing up in a firefighter family as a child?
Pros were kind of the cons too. So we got to ride fire trucks or have great meals on holidays. But then that also meant for Christmas, for one example, when you think of scheduling, which is what we do, was very used to the schedule just not being normal. So, we would have a Christmas day or a Christmas Eve, never both, with my dad and uncle, because they were on two different shifts and had a 24, 48 schedule. So it was just very clear to me early on, we just work around that. Christmas is this day this year, and that's when we all, will come together as a family and open gifts. But that was, a little bit of the con, but also made those moments more special, where it was more about the tradition and being together than the date. And I would say the family part of both my family being a big, very close family, and then also the fire service being, similar in that way, have just seen so many examples of some of my family members, but more other folks in the fire service that have stumbled or fallen down or struggled, because that's life. And just having folks there to pick them up. Was at a conference a few weeks ago for the Western Fire Chiefs, and they said, this is one of the last institutions where good men are still made and looking to be made. And I think that resonated a lot with growing up in that environment of it is about honor and integrity and respect and honesty. But you can also, dream big and do a lot of things, because the fire service is always changing, as much as they hate change. So personally, I loved growing up in a very first responder family, and I think the craziness of life tends to lend itself well to folks with that background. So I think they help me, stay calm under pressure too.
See, I couldn't agree more. I think it really is the most incredible calling. And when you're fire and EMS combined, you literally are the Swiss Army knife of the first responder world. And there's just nothing more noble that I've put my hand on my heart and say some of the most incredible husbands and wives and mothers and fathers have been firefighters that I know. They really are. And what's exciting as we get through this conversation, we're going to talk about how we can start bolstering some of these areas where the fire service does need help, so we can get back to where it truly needs to be to reach its full potential.
Absolutely.
So what about sports and exercise? What were you playing and doing as a child?
Baseball. I did 1 year of football and hated it too much. I like the football workouts, actually great training, but didn't like wearing all the pads, and they had me as a center for some reason and wasn't big enough for that. So baseball, mostly outfield, center field until sophomore year of high school, switched to track and cross country, and then also loved that. I always liked running and diving for the ball in baseball. So that was my, big thing. And then picked up a lot of volleyball actually in grad school. So 3 to 4 days a week of having a volleyball court nearby, and a big fan of sand volleyball. Anything hand-eye coordination I love, but if I have to kick a ball or use my feet to do anything other than run, I will be pretty terrible to have on your team.
I could kick someone in the head in a jump spinning kick, but I still struggle to even dribble a football. So there we go. I can relate. When it's on the floor, I'm not so good.
Can't even do that. So that's great.
What about career aspirations? When you were in the high school age, were you thinking of first responders, or were you thinking of the science side, or was there something else in your mind?
Thought of first responder way younger. So just seeing my dad, working, it was interesting. But firefighters have a aversion to technology, in a lot of cases on the line staff side especially. So It wasn't as interesting to me, like the hardware, the, like my dad studying for like fluidics tests for his captain's exam and showing me how the hose pressures varied. Like that was way more exciting to me. And he knew it and could do the math really quickly, but wasn't as interested to him. It was just, you know, the job. So definitely more the science and engineering that interested me. Thought I was going to do med school. Didn't realize it takes so long and so much money. Switched to thinking I would go to grad school. I did study biomedical engineering. So how you design pharmaceutical drugs and deliver them was my core focus, and takes 13 years to get a drug to market. That's a long time. So I kind of gravitated towards trying a lot of different things career-wise and seeing what fit. Worked at a pharmaceutical company, worked at a manufacturing company as an engineer on the plant floor to try that out. Definitely did not like that one as much, because there's not as much room for creativity or talking to folks and the things I enjoy. Decided to go to consulting, and that really was more of a get a breadth of experience. And I actually quickly became the company's advanced analytics trainer for the North America region. So anytime they needed something complex analyzed, I was like, great, I've never used this tool. Let me sign up to actually do the whole 4-month project on it. And I would learn it very quickly, and you'd have to, because it's a quick turnaround. And then that spurred me to say, I want to, you know, go to business school, because I saw plenty of folks doing it. I was at Stanford for business school, actually planning to go back into consulting. They pay for it for you. That was a great deal. You only have to go work for 2 years. But I thought that going back for the 2 years would pull me away from my long-term goal, which was to start a company. Wasn't sure, you know, where I would focus. So I told my dad over winter break, I have taken out all the loans and I am going to pay for it on my own. And I'm going to start a, you know, software business, and I'll focus on a specific industry, because I think that'll, you know, have me focus instead of building something for everyone. He said, I'll always support you. And if you want to fix a specific industry, you should fix the fire services software, because it all sucks. wouldn't say all by any means. And we have some great partners that we work with too, but there has been very, very limited innovation. A lot of private equity owned companies that don't care about the product or the service, which is a, you know, tough combination. And we spent a few nights going through his phone, or a few hours that night going through his phone. He couldn't show me most of the tools on his phone. So on his next shift, he FaceTimed me and then showed me, you know, most of the rest. And it was very clear there are a lot of disjointed systems. So my background being data interoperability and taking billions of rows of data from Fortune 500 retailers and having them in minutes make sense of that and say, here's what I need to know. A similar problem where you do not have weeks to run reports to look at data. How do you see the key info you need on the screen as a fire chief, for example, across these many different tools? That's why we decided to start with staffing, because I talked to tons of vendors and dozens of fire chiefs, and it's the only tool that touches every single user. So that's what got me excited to kind of combine, when you think of career aspirations, the kind of family background, but more my take on it, because it was more the, you know, technology nerding out on how the data flows side. But as I like to say, I'll handle all the boring back office stuff, which gets me excited. And then, you know, you can handle the rest.
Where did that love of numbers and data come from when you reflect back to early life?
I think it's just like a logical thinking mind, honestly. I both liked creative reading and writing, and then separately numbers. So I try to make sure I have balance in both. But one of the nerdiest things about me, I can say, is my family would always make fun of me, because growing up, my favorite book was my children's encyclopedia, which did have pictures, to be fair. But I would say, do you know the average weight of a blue whale? Or, you know, ask them ridiculous questions like that, because I would just constantly be reading information. So on the curiosity piece, I would say both for numbers or just, you know, wanting to read or learn more, that's always been a big driver.
When you were in the drug development world, as we stand here in 2025, you know, obviously there are some drugs that have done incredible things. And so you can't just tar everyone with the same brush. But we all know, I mean, OxyContin's a good example if we really want to use a, you know, a terrible kind of product and put it out there. You know, that there are a lot of elements of that industry that really aren't making things better. And some would argue even they create the consumer. So what were the, you know, the beautiful, exciting elements of that industry when you were in it? And then what if any, was the dark side that you saw?
So I was at AbbVie, who makes Humira, like one of the most profitable drugs before all the Ozempics of the world came out. It was doing, I think, $16-ish billion a year in revenue while I was there. And a drug is considered a blockbuster if it reaches $1 billion in annualized revenue for any extended period of time. So like this is one of the most profitable drugs ever created by human beings. While I was there, their indications for you are patent protected by this, only Humira can cover this indication, started running out because they've been using it for 20 years. So when the indication started running out, this I'll speak to the dark side first. It was very clear that they were focusing on marketing, on branding, on retaining their price power, on squeezing out any potential. And this is common practice. This isn't an AbbVie thing when you mentioned just the industry. So we don't want generics to be able to enter the market. We want generics to be perceived as worse. You'll still see like Mucinex or, you know, certain commercials where you could get a perfectly fine thing at Walgreens. Humira is dependent on people living like normal lives. It is not Mucinex. I have a sister with type 1 diabetes, for example. So she'll need insulin forever unless there are some novel treatments down the line that folks are working on. I think within her lifetime, a more long-term treatment is possible. But in the immediate future, she will always depend on pharmaceutical companies and even refrigeration in their transport to like, you know, live. So that is the flip side I've seen where like that makes life possible and increasingly more normal for folks who have long-term diseases. But the profit incentive that drives much of the industry to continue going up and up and up to please shareholders is the big problem I see. And actually, that's part of what inspired me to go into getting an MBA later on, years down the line. An MBA student at AbbVie said, you mentioned that you're investing more and more in R&D, and that's why you need to keep Humira prices high. However, you've shown that you've acquired more companies and that you've invested less and less each year in R&D in this slide. So how do you justify that narrative? And he asked that to the newly assigned chief strategy officer. So it was he did not, in my opinion, answer in a compelling way whatsoever, because there isn't a compelling answer. There's greed driving healthcare, health and medicine, let's say, across the board. So I think the practitioners are the ones squeezed most and the patients. But I think there are solutions that folks know about to that. It's just more of a, you know, motivation issue that drives many industries, but that one being so important to people living, I have obviously stronger opinions about that one.
Well, especially when you're talking about insulin, when you see just how preventable type 2 diabetes is, you know, and the huge demand on that and the stress it's putting on that, you know, product being developed and of course the affordability. If we were able to push, you know, the proactive preventative model and make Americans healthier and healthier. And I just had a guest on, Josh Clementi, who's got Levels, which is a online, you know, app platform. Again, you do blood work. There's a continuous glucose monitor that you wear for a month. But the idea is to empower the individual to constantly be able to look at their own health and make their own changes. Therefore, you know, chronic disease would come down immensely with all these tools. But then that frees up, you know, the insulin for the type 1 diabetic that we, you know, are still working on what the cause is and what the solution is. And the same with pediatric cancer. You know, the more cancers we can prevent, the more money and research can go into these diseases where, you know, these poor children were just born and they've got leukemia. That's where the money needs to go. So, I think companies can still make good money, but if there's
good
that
money, but it's not the most money. And that societal problem is, I think, what we will all grapple with in the next 50 years of how much is too much. We'll have real resource scarcity on things like lithium, where you can't just keep building the same electric car. So, yeah, I couldn't agree more that I think that's the, like, how do we get the folks at the wheel who are, you know, more doing the stock market investing or running these companies to make those more, will still make plenty of money, but managing those expectations for a better society. I see that as still the challenge for sure.
Yeah. Well, that's one thing I've observed is there's this kind of worshiping of monopoly. And you mentioned Walgreens. What's next to Walgreens normally? CVS. In every city that I've been to. So rather than saying, well, hey, you know, Walgreens, you get the north end and we'll get the south end. You know, it's like, well, I want to put CVS out of business. Or I want to put Walgreens out of business. And that's the model, to have all the money. But if you look at, you know, more historic human, you know, villages and towns, you know, the local blacksmith wasn't trying to put the other blacksmith out of business. They were just both serving the community. And I think we've lost that completely.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, then, so you talked about your father's kind of perspective on staffing. It's funny because I had one of my Anaheim captains developed one of the apps that I used through my career. Now, he sold it a long time ago, so how it's doing now is not a reflection of him. But at the time, it was a really great app. This was like 20 plus years ago now. Not even an app, no, a website. But even through my career, you know, I've seen the challenges of websites, and then also the fact that they're just not utilized properly because the people they're sold to aren't educated on how to use them, and you know, how to pull reports and how to empower the line personnel to really be able to be autonomous with their use of it. When you then enter this space and you know you start looking at what's out there, what were some of the most glaring deficiencies at first glance?
So the big one was any of these, and like you mentioned, just more now, not when they started. I think actually the reflection of every customer we've met is when every company started, they were great and they worked with us and they had service. So the number one thing we're working on is how we maintain that as we scale. And that's where venture funding can be a bit different from private equity funding, where we can plan years out and stick to that plan for at least hiring, for example. So like that piece, you know, we want to make sure sets us apart. The you mentioned folks not having the setup properly. That is the number one issue. A lot of the complaints that folks have, the tool might be able to do if it were configured that way, especially at setup. A lot of the vendors will charge more for change orders, or will say you need to spend on the engineering time that you don't get to just meet with folks to get a consult on how you could solve that problem. So to make, let's say, that staffing software, which is very complex, takes a ton of different systems and rules to work together to say now the right butt is in the right seat. If that's not set up correctly, it's very painful. And if you have to do workarounds on that process, now you're impacting staffing and the accountability for the day because it might not be reflected in the roster. And then you also are likely impacting pay because you're creating workarounds and you know different scenarios like shift trades, for example, are quite manual for how folks have to remember to exclude them. Then for the folks that were trading off at a different pay code, that is all automated for us, for example. So it's on the onboarding part and making sure you're set up to know we can actually automate that pay code change. You don't need to worry about that from a workflow point of view. We even can often reduce the number of pay codes that departments have by up to 20 to 30%, even out of the gate. We're doing with one customer we've had for a year, another payroll reduction because they realize they can use even less. So there's, when you think of that change management piece, we don't want to have folks bite off too much, but we lean in, we call it white glove onboarding to make sure that you have a concierge essentially walking you through the process. Everyone at the company speaks firefighter so that when you have an issue come up, it's not, what's a shift trade? Could you explain what that means? Very, very frustrating for a customer paying thousands of dollars a year to not have a customer support person who knows what they're talking about. So it's the onboarding process, a lot of workarounds in the product, and then the support thereafter as the, you know, kind of the like continuum of where folks struggle. And then where we've seen a lot of maybe not the biggest pain they're switching for now, but the folks that are more forward thinking say, I know these vendors are private equity owned, not innovating for me, regardless of the service, the product will not continue to evolve for me. So how do I plan for the future with a different vendor like Stationwise?
So you came in, is it three and a half years ago? Is that right?
Yep, just about. So, and yeah, most of that was really building and designing, as you could imagine, to make sure it was ready for prime time. But yeah, launched about a year ago with the, we're live with real customers and replacing what they use.
So you brought in a fresh set of eyes and you came in at an exciting time when it comes to technology with AI and some of these other areas. Mm. Talk to me about that. What has been this evolution of technology that's changed the way that we're able to use this kind of staffing software in 2025?
So I'll give you an example from Puget Sound in Washington State. Their assistant chief, we had met 18 months ago, just doing an initial demo. And his feedback was, he told us this later, but he said at the time to their other chief, this is really exciting if they can pull it off, but they've got a lot of work ahead of them. We met them again in March of this year. They were very impressed by the progress and wanted to consider actually replacing their current tool. They needed vacation auctions to work well. it kind of works with their current vendor, but they run them every year and have a lot of custom rules. They can't really visualize what's going on. Auditing is possible, but a lot of clicks and just not as intuitive as you'd want it to be. More importantly, those rules not being followed now means you have workarounds for everybody in the vacation pick process. So we custom built for them and a few other agencies our vacation bidding module then to say we'll have it ready this fall. We have two agencies, not including Puget Sound, actually running those auctions right now successfully, which is very exciting. But their assistant chief said in the September demo, when we showed them in person their auctions, we had folks, you know, log in with their phones and actually get the notifications of the auctions coming through. He emailed us after and said, you have to be using AI to develop the product or to move more quickly. And we absolutely do for designing and for writing a lot of the initial code, especially if it's simpler. But everyone has it. We always have humans that will actually audit it, do code reviews after, and then do extensive QA. And even some of that QA, we can automate by doing automated testing and clicking through the product on hundreds of devices at once. So we try to use AI or automation. I know AI is the buzzword now, but workflow automation, we do a ton of on our side too, to make sure that we're more efficient or saving time and can automate processes just like, you know, we do for customers. So on building things quickly, that's one. On another, we're building health dashboards and tracking sleep deprivation and exposures, for example. We're adding a phone number to call peer support. All of that we're building is in an AI tool. So not having engineers write a single line of code until we've worked with customers on when you click, what should it go to? We're building a, you know, real product, just the front end, with an AI tool that I can then, you know, design with customers, even in person, you know, live with them, so they can see the changes and react to them. That is a game changer when you think of previously, even for us a year ago, it was go to a designer. Hey, designer, here's all of this customer context because you can't join that meeting. Now, please design something. And then we have feedback sessions internally. We've completely flipped that around where the feedback and design is happening with customers. And then our designers figure out, here are the other considerations. Here's how this fits into our tool or how we make it more fit the data schema that we need, for example. So that's been a huge, huge change for us building net new features or products that aren't necessarily going to be built immediately, but make sure we build them correctly. And as you could imagine with health and wellness tracking, we want to make sure it's built for practitioners and by them, not, yeah, this will be a silver bullet to solve your mental health issues or all your sleep problems. Just more making it clear what can we do and building it with folks. AI makes all of that, you know, incredibly easy, not just possible.
So when you and I first spoke, you could tell my ears perked up when we started talking about the analysis of expenditure and then obviously the health side. And I want to get to the health and the mental health in a minute. But when I'm having this conversation about trying to make the 42-hour work week standardized across the whole country, so the 24/72, one of the biggest, you know, knee-jerk reactions is, well, we can't even afford it now. And the response is, you know, well, then go back and look at how much you're spending on overtime. What is your staffing model? So how many vacant spots are there? So your retention rate as well. And there are other factors. We don't even have to talk about that in the moment. But these, you know, these wherever they are in these departments, it takes them a long time. They have to go to the finance department. And, you know, there are these barriers. And also, are they being told the truth? Is another one, too. Yeah. So I think the first place to start is just simply talk to me about the kind of reports that can be run from this and can, you know, a chief or a battalion chief, whoever's able to run the report, be able to find out exactly how much these vacancies in these departments are costing them annually.
Mm, yeah. So when you think of where we are similar to other tools, you can export all your staffing data and run a report and, you know, filter out certain pay codes or project codes you want to. So you can do all of that quote reporting that folks are used to, where it'll spit out a file and then you'll analyze it. And it's usually just based on work hours. What we're now doing is more of an analytics dashboard for how many hours are folks working and showing that in a graph. So instead of your report spitting out a total, you can see by the month or even by the pay period if you zoom in enough, for example. So showing you the historical trends of what you're spending in hours right now is what we already do with our payroll analytics. What we're working on right now is very exciting, pulling in that fully loaded cost from your payroll tool each pay code for each pay period for each user. So saying, here's what this overtime for this step five captain cost according to your payroll tool, and we'll pull that in. So now you mentioned being able to track overtime, for example, even proactively saying, I want to see what my overtime budget is right now at this time. That should be possible. There's no reason it's not, but it takes 3 weeks. We found for many chiefs, especially at larger departments, to run a report, to go to payroll, like you mentioned, to work around everybody's schedules, to work around the transparency concerns and or data discrepancies of, well, we count it as this and we count it as this. That shouldn't happen when you think of everything being standard and tying to your budgets. So we can actually map each pay code to a city budget line and say, this is the budget this one will go to, or let you set cases where that will vary, of course, too. But we try to make that part easy to track in real time, the dollars. And then now the future planning or the scenario of what would have happened if we had a different schedule of this year becomes possible. So like you mentioned, if we want to switch to a 24/72 schedule and we're at a 48/96, like most of California, how much will that cost my specific department? That will depend on vacancy rate. Maybe if I have a ton of extra floaters or rovers, I don't need to hire as much. If I'm constantly understaffed, that's probably even more reason to hire anyway. So what is the case that we're going to make, and how can the tool help you make it in terms of now that cost is reasonably calculated for you? And it could even be a high, medium, and low case, because overtime obviously varies and you can't predict future overtime spend based on past data. Insurance companies have learned that with wildfire risk. So I think that would be foolish to say, here's guaranteed your overtime spend, but to give you a few scenarios and eventually let you play with the variables as a fire chief or as an analyst becomes really powerful, because the payroll folks can also have that view. It's about transparency, and we don't bill by user. So if you want to add city IT or payroll or give those folks accounts, you can control the permissions and just let them view the analytics, for example. So then there can be a more shared view where you can filter and download that data and say, yes, payroll, this is the right info, or city finance, depending on the department size.
See, I think this is so important, and we'll get into all the other things that you can do with the wearables and the autonomy of the first responder to be able to take trades and days off and all those things. I think they're very important. But as you alluded to, the step five captain, when people say, well, we had this many hours of overtime, it's like, well, that's great, but who filled it? You had a probie that had to take some time off, or you've got these vacant spots, and you've got these veteran firefighters that are trying to pad their highest three paychecks for their drop or their retirement. And so they're all chomping at the bit for all the overtime, and they're earning twice as much as a new firefighter. Mm-hmm. So being able to pull these reports, you can actually see what it's costing you. And then I would imagine as well, people that are off, workman's comp, that kind of thing, how many people are we getting injured, and pull reports so that you can really put in front of you, this is the downstream cost of the way that we're doing it now. And then, like you said, can you forecast, well, look, if all these spots were filled, and let's say we had, fitness standards and a strength and conditioning program, so we mitigated injury, what would be the projected savings? I think those are really important numbers for people to start advocating for their own workforce.
Right. Absolutely. And the only thing I'll add to that, it's not just about running reports. So our report view will let you run scenarios, and the analytics are helpful. We're building our rules engine a bit differently, where you'll be able to set automatic alerts. So let's say if a user is on workers' comp for 28 consecutive days, then change their pay code to this pay code and alert payroll admin and fire chief, because now they're switching to sick time. And maybe the user too. But what are the automations you might do to alert yourself proactively when certain things are happening or will, adding the spend to that, like when my overtime spend reaches 40%, but we're only 25% of the way through the year, can be really powerful. So it's not all on you to say, we just got back from a crazy strike team deployment and now I'm going to run reports. And even if those reports are faster, wouldn't it have been better to know while on the strike team so you can prep, or at least, let command staff know so you can handle it better when you're back? Those are the things we want to work on too, when you think of proactive versus, reactive.
Now, you mentioned sleep deprivation as well, and I think this is important. You know, again, my goal, 24/72, fully staffed, you know, full 72-hour period between each shift, gold standard, at least for now. I mean, if you look at the corporate space, you know, as I'm sure you know, there's a lot of progressive companies that are working 4 9-hour days now in the corporate space and having incredible results. But so talk to me about the capability for this to show, you know, the extended sleep deprivation that some of the workforce are getting.
So what we're starting with the sleep deprivation tracking is actually just coming from NERIS. So the incident reports that folks are already filling out, though we focus on staffing, we're licensed as a NERIS vendor to take in all their NERIS data. So let's say you use an incident reporting tool, that's your NERIS vendor number one. You can actually just list our station-wise code as number two, and now we can pull in all your NERIS reports as they're filed. So that gives us who is, or the apparatus and the incident and all the info for it. So that's exposures and the times. Times are going to be really useful for the sleep deprivation piece. So on our side, what we're building is the only way to view where or who is on which incident. NERIS doesn't care about people. They will not put people, you know, you can put them optionally, but there's no people, you know, assignment on NERIS. We only care about people in theory, or, you know, staffing tools do, but don't have that incident tie-in. So what we're building is, here's all your NERIS incidents that come into station-wise. We just pull those in automatically. We're already sending to your incident reporting tool the roster. So they'll keep, you know, we'll keep populating that. But some folks, especially at night, or if they're doing splits, might not be split on the roster, but they might ride out on the ambulance and go out on different calls than they're assigned on the roster. And that's universal across departments. So we're building a view for you to say, actually, this person was or was not on this incident. So now we will be the source of truth on who is actually on each incident, not just the butt in the seat. And that'll still be automated, but you can then move those folks, or they could say, actually, Chief, I wasn't on that incident. And then you can accept that change request, for example. So still going through approvals, but then putting it on both users and admin. So it's not on one person, you know, to manually move everybody around the incidents if they weren't on the right one. That's going to be really powerful for saying, now John Smith was on this apparatus at this time, and we know with certainty. So think, for example, just on the sleep side, there's more. I'll talk about incident reports first, but for sleep, we can know the timestamp of when each apparatus that person was out went out on calls. So we could think of it as the number of interruptions during their sleep window. We could think of it as the, because they're getting, you know, paged out for those at the very least, the number of the minimum amount of hours they could have slept, or max, I should say. So if you could have slept at most 4 hours, because that was the longest gap between your calls, now you're in red. Maybe if you're six or more, you're yellow, or, you know, 4 to 6, you're yellow. But being able to choose your variables and define those ranges is what we can work on. All of that data is already available. There shouldn't be enter the info, entering your exposures, for example. When I hear of departments doing that, that's a big reason we're building the health dashboards for some of the first agencies. Why do you have to self-report when NERIS is tracking those exposures? Well, because the incident reports, again, don't bring in that people view. So this is where more my, you know, data analytics excitement comes in. But we have all the personnel info. We pull training records in from their training tool, incident reporting, you know, records in there. And then that can let us track the narrative as well. Were you out on a traumatic call that mentioned a juvenile? Was it one that you flagged as traumatic for whatever reason? Maybe it's just a red, green, yellow smiley face. You're just like, don't want to talk about it. This sucked. How do you make it easy for a firefighter to actually give that feedback and not, well, this call was very traumatic and here's why? Because no one's going to fill that out, of course. So that feedback loop will be really powerful on what other pieces we can add. But just starting on sleep and exposures already can obviously give folks a lot of control over their, you know, data, like you mentioned, on the glucose monitor. How can I view that I have not slept well? Maybe I can turn on or off proactive alerts that say, you just exceeded your max work hours and we're on a mandatory shift. You had one call we would flag as traumatic. Here's an intervention of, you know, Nidra yoga, where you could practice breathing and sleep meditation work. Whatever the interventions are that work for you or that we would recommend, we can start to build based on data. But obviously, that's more if folks want to opt in, because it will never be, you know, Big Brother watching over you. It's more, yes, I choose to share my health data, because the number one thing is both making sure it works for fire chiefs and they're excited, but it's not Big Brother watching over you. Especially that's why we're not starting with wearables when you think of being tracked or what folks see. And there's a lot of trust that you want to build before that to say, now give us your, you know, heart rate data, and we'll actually standardize what that means. Trickier to do with hardware where they, you know, measure in different ways. So want to make sure it's meaningful from the start, and then we can add more. But you can obviously see a lot of ways that could grow when you think of just even adding a phone number with a button to call peer support is one other feature we were asked for, where it's now bringing a lot of that health information into one place instead of a link that hopefully they saved or, you know, a pinup on one of the stations.
I really like the idea of just the metaphor of the smiley face for a second, because, you know, you might have one person that goes to an MCI and, you know, minivan full of kids are all killed and they're okay. It didn't enjoy the call at all, of course, but they're okay. And then you could have someone who's got 28 years on, just goes on a pediatric, you know, what do we call it? DOA, basically. I'm thinking of the word now, but and that particular one is crushing for them because maybe they just lost, you know, their parent and they held their hand as they passed after a cancer diagnosis. So what doesn't seem very traumatic to us, you know, as far as, you know, on the spectrum of trauma calls, that might be horrendous for that person. It might just be, you know, the crib that they had in the house reminded of, you know, them losing a child 3 years before, who knows? So they have the ability to just say, I'm not doing so well. And then that initiating some opportunities for them to reach out, as you said, you know, privately themselves. Right. I think that's a phenomenal, I really do, because that way you don't have to sit at a firehouse table and say that one really stung. If you're in a group that maybe you don't feel comfortable with, it, one would hope that you'd be able just to talk, but we know that's not the case in some stations. So the anonymity of just being able to initiate a cascade of different options by saying, yeah, you know what, that was not a good call for me. I love that.
Maybe you get a prompt to say, here's a phone number, or like, here's the button, literally click this one button and it will call your specific peer support line that you can have, you know, whenever you need to talk to folks, if that's a resource you all have. Totally.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, another thing I think that does a huge injustice is they'll say, well, they only ran three calls. And what they need to know is, firstly, what were the length of the calls? Like some of the medics here.
Start and end time, important.
Yeah. So, you know, it's changed now. We've got a trauma center, but the medics here in the county used to have to transport to Shands. So that they're out in the national forest, they're round time, just as far as the actual transport time, would be close to 3 hours. And then you've got time in the ER.
Wow.
So, you know, one call is not the same, and that's not factoring in, you know, the target solutions training, working out, pulling hose, you know, doing blood pressure checks at the front door. So talk to me about, you know, extrapolating on single figure, well, they had a call, into using some of this to show the actual workload of a first responder.
Yeah, there's a lot of ways. Think of like the time horizon being what you could vary. Do I want to see how this person's doing on this one shift over a longer period? And then there's types of info you can see. So do I want to see how they've been sleeping according to NERIS? We're not, you know, doing self-reported sleep yet, but how, according to NERIS, have I, you know, has my sleep duration been? Where's that timeline of what traumatic calls I've been on? Whether that's we flagged it because it was a juvenile, or maybe because you said, you know, big red frowny face, and you can see a timestamp of when those happened. But the challenge is also making it anonymous, so folks will actually use the resources. What we've learned from a lot of fire chiefs that have more mental health resources, one chief, for example, in Virginia said, my station that has my mental health resources, I have not gone to in 4 years. It took 2 years of me not going by and walking by the room, which could violate confidentiality, before people started trusting that I would no longer walk by. And he'd made it very clear why he wasn't going from day one. 2 years is the stigma and the change of, great, now I can trust that this won't impact my career. So we do not take that anonymity piece lightly either, where I don't think the important part is oversharing with the battalion chief to say, hey, chief, this person's struggling. I think that helps a lot in some scenarios where the user is also okay with that. And maybe from NERIS or things the battalion chief could find anyway, great. But if it's me saying this was triggering to me, then maybe I have the option to say, I don't, This is just for me to say I want to trigger my interventions, but nobody can see it and it's actually anonymous, versus I'm okay notifying folks. Maybe I can change an anonymous one to notifying later if I say, you know what, I've gone to peer support and I'm okay with more people knowing. But whatever that looks like is also a really important part for the user to choose what the admin can actually go through, regardless of that time horizon.
So that's kind of the wellness, and then hopefully finding data to push the move to a healthier fire department. From, let's start with each of the ranks now. From the firefighter's perspective, you know, as you mentioned, we've got trade bids, we've got vacation requests, we've got PTO, all these different things. What are some of the kind of highlights of the station wise technology that you've got now that maybe are different to some of the platforms that people are currently on?
So my dad and uncle are two of the least tech savvy firefighters I know. If you say the word data, my dad will literally leave the room. So the biggest thing they emphasized was, don't make me remember a new password and don't make me log into a desktop. I have so many tools that don't work on a phone. So there's plenty of things we've made really easy. We call it firefighter proof for a reason. We say, try to break it and give it your all. But we'll block you from doing a shift trade 3 days before if you're not allowed to based on your rules. We enforce maximum consecutive work hour limits. We can show your accrual banks in the tool so you can say, I actually don't have enough sick hours, for example, to request this day off if that's what's in my bank. So we try to make it really easy for the user to both see what's happening. If you request time off from your phone, you immediately see this is not waiting for approval and it was auto-approved. Or you're waiting for two approvers. Here's who those people are and when they're going to approve it. Because it might go first to captain, then to a battalion chief, for example. So as the user, no new phone or no new password needed. And it's way more user-friendly entirely from your phone. We've also got, if you want to run it on a desktop and get emails and texts as well, and you don't have a smartphone, we've designed it around that as well, because there are some holdouts in some of the big departments, even in 2025, who insist on being pretty off the grid. So we've designed it around all of those fire use cases, where the goal is you're already not spending a ton of time in the tool, but it's quite painful in some cases because you have to go outside or fill out separate reports. And then the other side for them is transparency. And this goes for every user, but firefighters especially can now view their position on staffing lists as of a date. So I can go to any date on my phone and see how likely am I to get staffed to that shift. And then I can also view my time card and sign it if you want. Some folks say we're going to sign in payroll. This is just to view and export it, and we don't need users to sign. You can have users sign their own, and or employees or admins, I should say, approve on top of that. So that kind of time card auditing and then viewing my time. Eventually, we can also hopefully show the pay as well, because we'll pull that from the payroll tool, where the user can toggle between hours and dollars too. Maybe not as a full pay stub, but here's what you made by pay code, including your benefits, for example, which we'll add in for that fully loaded cost. So all that transparency on your phone versus, again, go maybe to your pay stubs, it's easier as a user, but most pay stubs are not easy to understand. In ours, for example, you can toggle between pay period and FLSA period if you're a firefighter on that phone.
I like the fact that you can see lists. I don't know if it was you or someone else was telling me the other day that they had the list, and the tendency was good to go to, you know, the people that constantly take overtime. I won't use this the phrase on this particular conversation, but and the one time that they just jumped straight to him rather than going through the list, there was a guy on the list that had never worked overtime, and this time he wanted to. So, I think it's not so much of an issue now because people are being forced to work over and over and over again. But when we get this back to where it should be, where overtime is once in a while, that's a very important thing. And there have been some underhand practices by certain, unions and the good old boy system, as it were. So being able to have that full transparency that, they tried everyone ahead of you, and then you took it or you denied it. I think that would alleviate a lot of, head banging in departments.
Yeah. And grievances, really. Like, we want to make sure that all of your rules are being followed. So max number of actors allowed off, max number, max consecutive work hours with your minimum break. You can always override those in our tool, but we'll warn you, here's the rule you're going to violate, override it, and then write a note. So then you have a system of record for it too.
One of the things I loved about Anaheim it was so autonomous. And again, one of the captains wrote that software, but it was coupled though with the way that the department thought. So if I think it was literally before 5 p.m. the day before I could take the day off. That's how, you know, how flexible it was. And we could project, you know, nothing really went through the chiefs. The only thing that we did is if I was in battalion one and I got overtime in battalion two, a firefighter there and myself could call the chief and say, hey, we're just going to stay on our own battalions if that's okay and stay in our own station. So that it didn't quite have that part down. But I really liked the paid leave system because that's what they did. There wasn't sick. There wasn't all these individual ones. There was just paid leave and you used it. However, with all these different systems that you've been exposed to, you know, what do you find is the most versatile when it comes to staffing through this very, you know, outside looking in lens that you have?
And when you say versatile, do you mean in terms of like the tool or how to approach those, I guess, accrual banks with more like the rule side or the software side, I guess?
I think really the labeling. So when, for example, you work for departments and it says sick time, you have to do that fake phone call where you're pretending that you're dying so that you can get your kid from preschool because, you know, you just got called and said that they got a snotty nose. Whereas in paid leave, you just took the time off and you didn't have to do any of that stuff. So the hours are the hours, you accrue them, they're allowed to be used, but there's a lot more guilt and shame with sick time, for example, than paid leave or vacation. My personal opinion is just straight paid leave seems to be the most common sense if you truly trust your people. But, you know, from the staffing models that you've seen, what are the best ones that you've observed?
Yeah, it makes a ton of sense. Like personal leave, paid leave, like making it clear it's a general category is common. Sick, we've seen commonly like sick and personal leave. So please only use your sick when you're sick. Most of your leave is in your personal leave bank, which helps the department track when are folks actually sick if they have, you know, enough of the latter. So definitely agreed on the labeling piece. And even it goes mental health and the stigma, for example. What if we show, even if you don't choose to submit it, your not just annual physical, which we're already showing in our health dashboard, but also your mental assessment. So annual mental screening and making that more normalized. Even if it's not filled out, how do we show it on the front screen and say, that's perfectly normal? That was what one fire psychiatrist, for example, recommended that we add in terms of normalizing that language. So not saying I'm sick, the fake sick routine. I think the biggest thing that I've seen on the firefighter side is they're already stressed about the schedule in so many cases, especially those Gen Z folks. So we've started running surveys, for example, and as no surprise, found a lot of the folks under 35 or so are not nearly as motivated by money and salary and overtime as everybody else was. So this is causing a complete change in how folks think and prioritize about what they think of staffing or how the shifts change. And that whole arc of, like you mentioned, well, I'll just take shifts when I retire. But a lot of the older folks want to spend time with their kids or enjoy empty nesting. They don't get to because they're getting mandatoried in more too. So a lot of the past expectations are also changing. So, you know, again, as much as the fire service doesn't like change, it's constantly been evolving. And that's the next one I see with how the younger members don't see things, you know, the same way with how they prioritize it. And we'll see maybe a like even in one department, a dichotomy of how folks view sick. I don't think Gen Z folks care about using sick time at all. I think they want whatever bank they have, but I've seen on the, maybe like the folks that are more career minded or want to be on the, you know, officer track. Is this going to count against me if I'm now taking off sick? Maybe my wife can take off of work instead and I'll ask her. But that stress and fatigue that you put on folks by saying this is labeled as something that you're not using it as, it's extra friction that doesn't need to be there for sure. So I think being thoughtful about, are we showing, you know, mental assessment, even if no one fills it out, what are the signals that you want to send? But again, not just to have it be fluffy. If it's sick causing a stressor for folks, which it has in some cases, why not call it, you know, personal leave? There's plenty of reasons, most of them being because we've always had it that way. And, you know, the union might be up in arms, but the naming does, I think, at least matter.
Well, firstly, it's funny that you said about Gen Z, because that's exactly what I've been talking about. You know, if you want to attract that generation into the fire service, you've got to fix the things that are broken when it comes to physical and mental health, and they will come back. You know, you give them a work week that allows them to perform at a high level and be home when they're supposed to be home and rest right. and recover the way they're supposed to. I guarantee you will have lines around the building again. The other thing with the labeling, I was the guy that always had almost nothing in the bank because I used my time proactively. I'm like, I know I'm tired. And this is, I was getting mandatory all the time. So I'm like, this is how I'm going to, you know, keep my health, keep my mental health, is I've got to take a mental health day. I've got to take a day off just to simply not have to wake up at 5 a.m. and go back to the station again. But that's not sick time. I'm not sick. You know, so this is the point, is that reframing it into just simply, no, I'm going to give a rest and recovery day, just the same as you would if you're an athlete. You know, you're getting kind of a little bit of burnout going on, take an extra rest day, and then you get back in the gym. So I think there's a lot of kind of a lot of great things that you can get away from kind of redefining what a simple day off is. It can just simply be, I think I just need to be with my family today. I need to wake up and have breakfast
without,
with my kids.
Without the judgment or the fear of career retribution is the big one, because that's the stigma, obviously. Think it's not unique to fire, though. Like, think of airlines, like pilots especially, or air traffic controllers, who are both going through struggles right now, but air traffic control especially. They're essentially not allowed to experience any form of depression. If you are flagged in any capacity as like, yeah, I experienced depression, someone lost their wings immediately and had previously enjoyed their job. So most folks have learned that you don't speak up and you suppress it and you just push on, and that's the job. That is putting people in some of the most critical positions of like airports, fire, very critical infrastructure and support for everything that happens for either emergencies or the day to day. That is a huge problem. And making it more accessible for those folks to take the time off they need, regardless of what it looks like, to remove that stigma. That stigma is very real. If the career retribution is real for pilots, I don't think many firefighters would say that they've never experienced a chief or don't know of any chiefs who are anti-mental health, who are very old school and say, that's just the job, figure it out. I don't care that you struggled on this call, or it's, I'm sorry that you did, but you have to, you know, pull yourself up, which could be more ableist than some folks like. And that balance is tricky to strike on. How do you enable those folks across all of the different needs and resources they might have or want? And then also make sure you're not stigmatizing or penalizing their career. I don't think other industries that have the similar demand of, sorry, we're around the clock, we can't shut down, I don't think they've figured it out either. So a lot of opportunity to hopefully help folks across the board to say, this is a better way of naming it, of handling it, of scheduling folks. You have to budget for more hours and time off, and thus more people. And here's why and what that looks like. Like you mentioned, on more quantifying that burnout, that's what I get excited about, because putting it in dollars context is easier than saying, what would we have spent? Or what is the physical duress that these folks might be under? Or maybe if we have a lot of folks quit, then we have to hire more, but they're not there. That's a risk that we might spend more on as well. So plenty of ways we could frame, you simply have to pay more so folks aren't working such crazy schedules. There's very few ways around it, but I think those arguments are hard to quantify currently. So that's what I get excited about making it. Again, not that weeks or months of report running or working with payroll, but at your fingertips.
Exactly. And this is, like I've said, in so many of these areas, you could argue the shutdown that there's, you know, is causing the issues with air traffic control and federal firefighters and our military.
Yeah,
that are, you know, still working for $0, but it's about that we don't need more money. You know, the money is downstream. You look at the cost of healthcare in America at the moment, it's 20% of our GDP. So imagine the trillions of dollars you would save if you just made Americans healthy, that you wouldn't.
How do you get middlemen in healthcare to just hand over their money? That is the question I definitely think about at times, but I couldn't agree more. It's waste of money that doesn't go to the human health outcomes. And if you think of how hospitals are even rated by like reimbursement rates or how they do, there's no similar review for insurance companies, or they all track how much they deny claims and brag about it. So I think having a more thoughtful approach to how the healthcare infrastructure, of which fire is a big part, they've only started getting the Medicare, Medicaid grants to cover ambulatory services in the last 5 to 7 years when, you know, Medicare and Medicaid have expanded. That is great, but it is just the start. When you think of how many healthcare services is an EMS department a fire and EMS department committing by the time they deliver that person, the resources driving that person back. Private ambulance companies have a very different amount they bill for. So why can't, the public make up some of that difference or get reimbursed where there's a market rate that folks are well below in most cases because you're providing a public good, but that money going to those private hospitals is a huge part of the problem. It's not yet in the government hands, but I think that's why a lot of people advocate for single payer healthcare or an alternative to not everything needing to be so expensive on the middleman side. I couldn't agree more, though, that how you extract that money in a thoughtful way. I think these grants that cover Medicare and Medicaid are a great one because it directly aligns service with the outcome. How can we carve off more of that given the number of services would be my, immediate thing that could be lobbied for that more achievable than a single payer healthcare system, probably.
Absolutely. And the same with cities, with their fire departments. If you look downstream at overtime costs and, lack of retention. So you train people, you equip them, and then they leave. The medical retirements, the line of duty death payments, the workman's comp claims, the lawsuits from exhausted firefighters making mistakes. I mean, it is, depending on where you are, millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions. Like LA, their four-year overtime budget, overtime was $1.2 billion. So when people say we don't have the money for extra personnel, I'm like, you do. And this goes back to what we're talking about.
Planning to spend it in the future. You just, not in the
exactly.
Right spot.
So let's, let's run these reports and show you. So it's black and white in front of you and you can take it to your employer. All right. Well, then let's talk about training now. I was a firefighter and also a paramedic. So I had a lot of CEs that I had to do, biannually. Talk to me about the opportunity for this software to keep, stay on top of certifications and all the other areas.
Yeah. So Target Solutions is the training tool used by, I won't say most, but a third of fire departments, let's say, or so. Fire engineering training is a new one that started more recently. They're also a partner of the Western Fire Chiefs like us. So they're the kind of recommended vendor that are doing things differently. We can integrate with both of them and pull in training data. So, paramedic, for example, as a qualification needs to get renewed in Illinois every 4 years, where my dad's department is. That's a new requirement for Illinois, where previously it was you're a paramedic, just keep up with your trainings, but not needing a formal recertification. So we can pull in the credential and if they're qualified for it into our tool directly from your training tool and even the expiration date, which is optional. So if there's an expiration date, we can say, I think it's set for 30 or 45 days out for the default, but fully customizable to say X days before it expires, turn it yellow and change it to expiring soon and notify me, my training chief, and anybody else that you want to notify. Same thing when it actually expires. So we can help proactively track on a workflow basis where we have the messaging and communication system and the mobile app where folks can use, in a user-friendly way. But the training chief who has spent 20, maybe 10 years in Target Solutions or the tool of choice to input all that training info doesn't need to change the workflow or export all that data. And a big challenge we see with folks is, they're pitched on interoperability, and interoperability is adopt our platform. And there's more than one vendor doing this, but you have to have all of our suite and maybe we'll plug into some other tools, but it'll be a very minimal integration. We have more. So CrewSense and Target Solutions, for example, are owned by Vector Solutions. They do not communicate that training data with the roster. So if you have relevant credentials to staffing, they are then manually updated in CrewSense. To me, that makes no sense. They're the same tool. They have the info in some case. Maybe it's a workaround they have to do to send it because it's not, maybe it's two tools they bought that they don't plug in as well, but it's possible because we're pulling the data from Target Solutions into our tool. So going that step further to pull in trainings or other, very time intensive workflow things you all are already doing, we don't want you to do duplicate effort on. Or let's say you go out on a call right when you add someone in, add them in Target Solutions to a new credential and say you're paramedic qualified, forgot to do it in station wise, and now every roster thereafter is incorrect because you haven't actually gone in to update that yet. So we want to make sure we're not blocking folks and that you don't have to worry about that lapse where the accountability is wrong either. And only other thing I'll add, those are just two tools we're starting with. We just met a department in Washington State this week that's going to sign, which is exciting. They have a custom solution that they built with Power Automate. So they can automatically send training records to a calendar, essentially. We're just going to have them automatically send those trainings to us. And then we'll figure out this, you know, training record matches this credential. And whenever they send it, we'll keep it up to date. Very different process than a Target Solutions API. So our goal is not one size fits all training, even, for example. Same with payroll. When we send the data to now 10 plus payroll tools we're working on, we can customize exactly what that data export looks like, or in the case of training, the import to. And not even the file format, but even the process. Maybe you want to email us, but a different department wants an API. Sometimes it's easier for city IT to automate an email to a, you know, station-wise email account than it is to set up that API. So we can work around, as you can imagine, with legacy city systems, pretty much anything by now. So training is no different there.
One more area, and I'll put it to you, see if there's anything that we've missed. But when I think about, you know, a lot of the times when people get promoted to BC, you know, one of the biggest gripes is that they're there just for hours with staffing. So that area and any other area you want to talk about, talk to me about efficiency, because the biggest thing is, you know, if we can automate areas, then it frees up time for, you know, firefighters to run calls, for officers to keep us all in check, and then obviously for the battalion chiefs to get the staffing done so they can focus on more important things.
Yeah. And I appreciate the distinction by user type too. So most fire chiefs tell us, I don't care about adding or saving recliner time. Folks will go out on the calls they need, and like, they're not as worried about the time saving. So what we really help with there is the error prevention, the you don't have to go doing corrections for folks. Folks are complaining less because they have everything at their fingertips and can make the requested changes that you allow them to. Otherwise, they have to ask their chief like they were anyway. So that's one piece on the, you know, what we make easier for the user side, but not so much automating or time saving, because they're not hopefully in the tool too much anyway. For the battalion chief job, he was first on the captain's list, got promoted first in his whole department, took the battalion chief test, even though his battalion chief class is like 2 to 4 years on and none of them are retiring in this test cycle. He wanted the acting reps. So then next time around, he could, you know, potentially qualify. He, the number one captain on that captain's test for at least the last promotion, said, I didn't sign up for this job to sit behind a desk all day. I hate it. I'm learning all the, you know, stuff with our current tool that you mentioned you all are fixing. So it's been nice where we're now doing more demos to show them how it works because of that. But the difference, the number one thing, if you ask, I've asked dozens of battalion chiefs across a dozen plus states, what is the number one thing you would change about your job? You know, wave a magic wand, what would you change? I would rather spend more time in the rig and less time behind a desk. So that is the number one job we are trying to solve for that battalion chief. Any requests you can approve from your phone. So you know that it's following your shift trade rules, max consecutive work hours rules. They have enough accrual hours in the bank. You can actually just hit approve on that or deny on your phone on the go. No need to get back to your desktop. And because it works on any device, I mean, Apple or Android, but you can also staff from a tablet or a Toughbook. Now you can be in the rig and actually handle that staffing too, beyond just the, you know, butts and seats part. All the automation can run it behind the scenes. So it's not you manually dragging. Our rules engine can make sure if this vacancy opened up, and it should automatically fill it. It's not running at like 4 p.m. every day. It'll just constantly check and then run to fill based on your rules, for example. So that getting them into more calls and doing the job they want to do. And then that senior most person that you're otherwise paying to sit behind a desk and essentially keep the lights on can actually go in the field and see, are the policies being followed? When we think of that health dashboard, how are those folks, you know, I might have that data that says these two folks are red. Maybe I'll go out on the calls with them and just see how they're doing on the next day because they had a rough shift the day before and they're out on a 48 now. Just making it a lot easier for that person to engage with the department, both doing the job they love and that they're better suited to, is huge. And then we save a ton of time for the payroll admins and the fire chiefs on running payroll and reporting. But just since you mentioned more the fire suppression side, definitely that battalion chief one is close to home, where I've seen firsthand how my dad is, he's retiring without taking the next battalion chief test because he does not want to do the job. Despite being number one on the captain's test, which I think is very telling of how that job has set itself up. It's very much sit behind a desk. I don't want to do it. I hate technology. If the technology, the only other thing I'll add on that is firefighters say that the very overused trope is we hate change in the way things are. I don't think that's actually true. I think if you have software tools that are not designed for you, that are not implemented based on your needs, and then lack the support thereafter that you deserve, I would be very unhappy myself with that change too. And that's been the norm and not the exception. So the distrust of industry-specific software, I think, is actually well-earned. So what we try to help with is both getting that person out of the seat and into the field more, and then also making sure that we can help with so much of that change management process. So it's not, here you go, upload your 100 users and figure everything out yourself. You're actually in the tool and then seeing immediately how it can save you time with that support then along the way.
No, I think that's brilliant. And you think about just autonomy again, I use that word a lot, but there's many examples where a battalion chief will monitor a radio throughout the night. And for that chief's performance, that chief's longevity, it's insanity. Because what needs to happen is you go to bed, go to sleep, and the big boys and girls on the rigs will let you know if they need you. And then you'll get toned out and you'll go join them. And I think it's the same with this. If you can build more autonomy in the staffing model, and like you said, if you know if they meet the criteria, then it automatically approves. You shouldn't have right. to be pushing a green button if they've met all the things that you need. And I love that fact that when you're talking about, then you can actually look, well, how are my people doing? Have I got anyone that's hit the red or that is on that 36 straight? This maxed out our hours. Let me go check on them. But also, these are the people that are going to be running the big scenes. So if they're not out there on more calls, if they're out there doing the training, going on the tower and doing all the things that the other firefighters should do, then the people that we rely on the most to make the most important decisions on these massive scenes are arguably undertrained and deconditioned. Absolutely. So the less time in front of a computer, the more chance that person has of being the right person for that job when we need them the most.
Absolutely. That's a great point too. On the practitioner side, it's not the job that you want that person doing, both with how expensive they are and how much you've trained them, but to your point, for how important they are in that emergency situation. I hadn't considered that too.
Well, before we go to some closing questions, are there any other areas you want to highlight?
The only big one, I guess this is a point I always like to drive home, is love to ask that fire chiefs, police chiefs, any first responder leader who is currently used to subpar technology and or service to ask more from their vendors. So why can't you build this custom export for me? If you have to build it, how much will it cost? Why is it more than a one-time payment? Because once you've set it up, it should be done. I don't need to pay an increase in my ongoing rate for this, for example. How do you have vendors that will work with you to even say, yes, we'll customize? So we like to, for example, we have a custom roadmap where when you log into your tool, you can see all the upcoming features that you want. And you can even say, I don't want that one. Can you turn it off for me when it comes? And that's how we get your feedback weeks or even months in advance of some of the big ones. But asking vendors to do more and not expecting to work around the limited pieces they might have is what I would push everyone to do. We, for example, an incident reporting tool said, you cannot send more than 32 characters for the apparatus name to our incident tool. That has to be maybe 2003 character limit. I've never heard of something like that. So we said, that's not acceptable. No, we're going to send you longer apparatus names than that, though they'd previously been told for years that they were unable to do that. When we as a vendor push back on a different vendor instead of the customer doing it, it took one day. We now can support up to, 200 something characters. So now putting in whatever name limit you want, so you can put in the apparatus name, the incident number, you're not limited to squeezing things into a tiny space. Those are really impactful for you to run reports, or you can literally track more data. And that's so simple for, these companies to change in many cases, or companies like, Stationwise. So just would push folks to ask more of vendors, ask them to be collaborative. And if they're not, and you can't find a vendor that is, that's where you can have more of those integrations work around those legacy systems. So finding one tool to rule them all, I think, has been a bit of a dream for a lot of chiefs. And they've started to realize, as we've had a lot come to us for the staffing side, staffing is very complex and hard to automate with a lot of legal liability, and it impacts pay. We take that very seriously, and we, you know, that trust in us all being in the fire service or from family members matters a lot to us. So just making sure that we similarly say, push other vendors to, if not do that, to integrate your systems or to come up with a custom report if it's not you doing another workaround that adds 5 to 10 hours. Because as folks have seen, when the software changes, that workaround doesn't work anymore, or it requires more time, or now we have to document a new process because the workaround's a little different. Those are all the things we want to, you know, avoid and be more of a trusted partner. So just having more of, you know, IT vendors that can help support your IT needs, not put more work on, you know, fire departments in many cases don't have dedicated IT, as you know. So for a lot of those smaller agencies, how do you put that work on the vendor and just ask more for them to, you know, solve some of your biggest tech challenges, really? So we get fired up about, at least. So I'm a little biased.
Yeah, well, rightly so. All right. Well, I would love to go to some closing questions before I let you go. The first one I love to ask, is there a book or are there books that you love to recommend? It can be related to our discussion today or completely unrelated.
Good question. Plenty of books to recommend. I would say one that jumps out is Never Split the Difference. Negotiate Like Your Life Depends on It. It's a now more recommended in business school book, but I found it more helpful than anything I've ever learned in business school about negotiating, let's say. But I like to think of it as how you ask how and what questions to drive in challenging situations to a helpful outcome for everybody. I found it to be very helpful from a leadership point of view. And it's written from the, he was a former hostage negotiator for the, I want to say FBI or CIA, insert three letter government org. He learned through many mistakes, many, probably FBI then, many failed US-based hostages, that it did not work. And they had close calls, you know, hostages killed. He learned this perspective after decades of doing that. And I think it also has a lot to say about how to stay calm under pressure and how you respond when your emotional triggers might be high, especially if you're talking to someone who's more antagonistic. I found a lot of the values that fire chiefs have reflected back of their leadership style to be kind of more codified in that book of, here's tactically how you ask those types of questions or how you deal with a person like that. So despite it being on the negotiating side, I found it really helpful from a, you know, leadership point of view too. And then only other one I would recommend is called Small Giants. Way shorter on this one, but it's essentially how companies can be great instead of big. So instead of going for growth and like going for up and to the right constantly, how can you be a gigantic company that chooses to say no to growth opportunities that would dilute down your profitability or dilute down your mission and focus? That's not something we have to do yet, thankfully, but long-term, want to make sure that we're saying no to the right opportunities so we don't dilute down that service that we're offering now. So that's been a really helpful book for me. The only one I've seen, including at Stanford Business School, on how you can build a very large business that is still for years later dedicated to the customers. So not a perfect Bible on what to do, but a ton of examples on how other companies have done it that have been very helpful to, you know, think outside of the box.
Firstly, on the FBI thing, the reason why it's probably them because the CIA would have had everyone right. killed that was involved.
Exactly. So. And they're not international. So CIA would say, we've taken care of it. We sent in a drone strike, all done.
But it's interesting. I think we talked about this when we spoke before, but it's really sad. I have had some great friends in excellent businesses with a social model built in that sadly was sold to, you know, whatever you call it, a corporation or whatever the term is, that were then, you know, systemically disassembled. And it's mm-hmm. the very question is like, how big do you get before you say, all right, this is as big as we're going to get. We're going to keep delivering this great level of service. And we're not, again, as we mentioned earlier, not chasing that holy monopoly of having all the money. And I've seen it with a great restaurant we had in Gainesville that expanded and I'm assuming overextended. And then both of the restaurants closed down. And I've seen it with some of the, you know, the people that I know closely, but you know, what is it about that element that people end up chasing the money rather than hanging on to the very thing that made them successful in the first place?
I think and from what I've seen, it's not the person changing so much. Like you mentioned on the founder of, you know, the tool in Anaheim, it's when you sell that product to almost always a private equity fund or a growth stage fund that has majority board control. That's why we're making sure the board stays founder controlled for us. That is our big, that and raising venture capital funding where we can get millions of dollars in funding that might be inaccessible to other companies are what we want to do to set ourselves apart so we don't need to sell out and can build for years to come. Gives us a lot, you know, of conviction to build the right thing for folks. But then after setting up, like, I would like to do this for the next 20 years. Maybe I can step into more a president role and find a CEO, but not for 20 years. I've got some time. So I want to make sure we've set up, and this is a little bit at the end of Small Giants. Like the challenge I would have for that book or beyond is how do you build a business that never has to be bought or sold and can outlast the next generation? Like you have to, it's not about you predicting what happens in 50 years. It's about you setting up systems and leadership that are adaptable enough to still meet those needs and those values for those years to come. So very big challenge, and not one I would say that was the top of mind for business school where it's like sell things and move really quickly. But I want to make sure we can build a generational business for, you know, really decades to come that is built to last and isn't then just bought and sold to the next highest bidder. So don't yet know what that looks like, but I've thankfully got some time to figure out exactly how we might structure that down the line too.
I just shared an interview that Simon Sinek did with one of his mentors who I forget the industry he was in, but, you know, huge, huge business. But like Richard Branson, like so many of these successful entrepreneurs that you hear, it was initially or is still initially people focused. And it seems like, you know, if you take care of your own people, then the product, the customer, obviously that kind of, you know, by osmosis, they end up being happy too. Is that what is taught in the book? Is it's, you know, the human side, because that's what's discarded so much in a lot of the first responder professions at the moment. And I think we need to circle around and again, take examples from the business world, the successful business world,
right,
and refine the most valuable commodity that we have, which is the human being.
Yeah, and that's the big root of all of these companies. So it's the hyper focus and obsession on the customer and their needs and not deviating from it, which might cause you to say no to some opportunities. And then the relentless focus on like bettering and repurposing and like continuing to upskill employees. As an example, there's a sandwich chain in Ann Arbor, Michigan that had a woman who was incredibly talented and helped handle a lot of their operations, but she wanted to leave and go to law school. She said, I've learned a lot here, but I want to be a lawyer. They decided to take a very big bet for a early at the time sandwich shop, and they paid for her to go to law school. They then paid for her to come back and employed her as a lawyer, despite not having perfect work lined up yet for exactly how it would fit in. And she went to build out entire other company structures for how they have an overarching portfolio company, and they have the sandwich group, a gift shop one, very well structured, but she helped set up that entity. And it's not that she needed to be a lawyer per se to do it, but her retaining her, when you think of the people side, was the biggest thing. She knew the business so well. She'd been there for years and cared about it. So we have every 2 weeks internally for Stationwise, we have upward feedback where folks give me feedback. So it's a separate time to make sure that they are getting their needs met. But then between those, we have meetings on what's your professional development goal? Like, do you want more product management exposure where we could carve off 10 to 20% of your time to be that in the next few months? We don't like to wait, you know, a year for a promotion because we're a startup and can move faster. So that both employee development, making sure folks stay motivated and excited, and then growing enough as a company so we have room for them to land. And then we can, you know, have a vision to say, yes, let's put you in a new type of role and see how it goes. But focus on that person and keeping them in versus what they're doing, not how the fire service is thought of, or to be fair, how government can think is flexibly, because you have to have a very specific role and job description for your budget. And if it's gone, you lose it. But just that same thoughtfulness of, because once it's gone, we lose it, how do we commit to these people and retool or reskill them within the same budget challenges every agency has?
Love it. There's so many parallels. All right. Well, the next question, what about film, documentary, television, any that you love?
Ooh, definitely. Big fan of any cyberpunk dystopia, usually. So Black Mirror, I really like Interstellar as a, I guess, dystopia beginning. But yeah, good movie for sure. But yeah, anything that's a like science concept and like big challenge, like how will we solve this? Arrival, I also liked because it gets into like language and communication with aliens. So just those types of like movies, I would say, really get my gears turning. And then same with books, I'll gravitate for the more personal reading to the sci-fi side. So truly anything in that realm. Have started watching more horror movies, which I like, but sadly with the time movies take, I usually am more of a TV show person these days. So yeah, any dark or scary TV show that has a sci-fi twist, I'll probably be interested in.
Absolutely. There was that, every time someone says Black Mirror, it's that one episode where there's the guys in the video game.
Oh yeah, that was, I actually just
always pops in my head.
I'm on a plane and I was like, this is not what I thought when I fell asleep for this last. It was a very strange episode, but yeah.
It was indeed.
It's possible with technology, so.
There we go. All right. Well, the next question, is there a person you'd recommend to come on this podcast as a guest to speak to the first responders, military and associated professions of the world?
Oh, yeah, two, I guess, came to mind immediately. If you haven't met him yet, Chief Niemeyer, he's the Boise Fire Chief and the president of the Western Fire Chiefs Association. So we're a partner of the Western Fire Chiefs. They put on, they're very much a tech forward. When you think of all the different fire chief groups for each region, the Western is at the forefront of wildfire, and they've had to figure out a lot of interoperability for the mutual aid that comes from that or the larger scale events they've had. So they're way ahead when you think of what technology have we already tested and worked through and struggled with that the fire service needs. And Boise is a large, just under the metro department size. So he's seen it both as a practitioner and then also on the leadership side for the Western. So definitely would recommend, like, very thoughtful perspective on how technology is evolving in the fire service. And then they're hosting innovation summits to help be a part of that change and then to relay that feedback to, you know, vendors, for example. So definitely would recommend him as part of that feedback loop. And then David Blankenship is the other one, where he's he's works at Emergent now, but was one of the initial folks at Intera. And he saw very much how like the data piece for Intera helped, but Intera doesn't do as much on the workflow side. And he wanted to do more to replace current tools they use and to do it cheaper. So Emergent is the only tool I've met that prices by call volume. So it's a way, a lower price than folks usually pay and predictable pricing. And they are expanding to, they have incident reports, an incident command view, kind of a digital, you know, command board. But he, because he was at Intera and has been in the fire service and then decades of working on the software side, a lot of really helpful experience. And also a big, like, when you ask me questions about, like, how have you seen the fire service changing, a lot of what I've been inspired by is him seeing, you know, years before that even, and how long some of those changes take, to give me a perspective of how quickly, you know, the technology adoption is going now, post-COVID especially, but in general. So he's definitely both been around the block and helped with a lot of the tools, including some of the big ones.
Brilliant. I appreciate that. Thank you. Very last question then, before we make sure everyone knows where to find you and Station Wise, what do you do to decompress?
Good question. Reading is a big one, which I alluded to. I read like 1 to 3 books a month these days. So pretty frequent reader, especially with all the air travel to fire departments. I have a dog that is my best friend and love to take her everywhere. So she can fly on planes. She'll travel with me, not quite every single department, but to a lot of the longer trips I'll do especially. So do like 4 miles of walks a day with her, and she's pretty spoiled these days. And then the other big one is, I would say, video games. Do plenty of other working out when I can, but I built my gaming computer. Big fan of tons of different types of video games, except first person shooters, which bore me sadly, but pretty much any other game. I like playing local ones with friends, and I now have a VR headset. So debating bringing that in when we eventually get a Station Wise office to have some, you know, fun game nights, which could be good.
How advanced is VR these days? I had the, I think it was the second Oculus, which was good, but you know, I don't know, there was still a lot of limitations. You certainly didn't feel like you were really.
I went for the Valve Index, which is far more expensive. I won't tell you how much. I don't remember, thankfully, because it was long enough ago. But each lens is a 4K lens, and it needs like a constant power cord plugged into the TV or the computer. But completely different night and day experience. It's still not perfect enough that I'm like, it's more of a novelty. So I think it needs a lot more in terms of you can wear it for a longer time without your eyes getting strained. It's still, even with two 4K lenses, that's so close to your eyes. So it's not perfect. And I think to add double the pixels would obviously make the processing power way worse. My hope is actually USB-C makes this more possible because you can transfer power and display at the same time. So as that comes out more, I think maybe, but I'm not for the mobile ones that are standalone. I'm not as much a fan of those yet because it's so far away from where you could wear it for a long time without getting the headache, at least for me. Still very cool because that the Apple backpack I liked, whatever, I forget what that was called, but thought that was awesome and very impractical and I would never use it. But if I could have it more in backpack form and not worry about the power, then I would be all over that. So still a ways away, it looks like, but hopefully in the next like 5 years or so.
Yeah. Yeah. There was a boxing game that I liked and it was a great workout. Like you're literally shadow boxing, but I almost put my fist through the glass door a couple of times. So I'm like, okay,
I fractured a hard plated display thing and it just cracked the acrylic on it. I'm like, that hurts so badly, but my finger seems intact. So yeah, you definitely have to back away and have enough room cleared. It was pretty painful.
Absolutely. All right. Well, for people listening then, where can they find StationWise online, learn more about it? And then where are the best places to find you specifically?
Yeah, it's just www.stationwise.com, station, WISE, all one word. And then we have plenty of information on our site about how the product works. So that, you know, can show folks more about the scheduling side, the integrations and all that good stuff. For reaching out, you can just fill out the form on the site or email me, just Marcus, MARCUS, also at stationwise.com. But yeah, always happy to chat with folks. If we have a lot of folks, we're adding 6 new states between now and the end of the year, which is crazy. So we've added about 1 new state a month for the last few months and folks are now signing this month. So always open to talking to folks across both the US and started talking to other countries too. So easy to get a hold of us that way. And if you have any pains with your staffing, you know where to reach me. Always happy to chat about it.
Well, I want to thank you again. It's been a great conversation. As I alluded to, obviously the elements that are really going to improve the physical health, the mental health, the time at home, that excites me tremendously. You know, being able to show, hey, this is the perceived cost of actually making a healthier workforce, for example. But obviously for all the people listening that are still in at these different ranks, I'm sure they're seeing this as such an improvement as far as efficiency and autonomy, like I said. So I want to thank you so much for being so generous with your time and coming on the Behind the Shield podcast today.
Of course, yeah, I really appreciate you having me.